Last week, a photo of a Black Panther watch party went viral. It's just a photo of a group of friends, Hollywood creative types, celebrating a new movie's release. What might have seemed remarkable to the Twitter sphere was that the couple dozen screenwriters and producers in the picture were Black men. The guy who posted the photo to social media had this to say: "We are often told that people like us don't exist, that we don't achieve, that we don't accomplish. The truth is that writers aren't always on the red carpets or at parties. We create, and the act of creation means we have to be invisible sometimes. This is our excellence. This is what it looks like." I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to talk to the KCK native in the middle of that picture, Aaron Rashawn Thomas. He's the producer of SWAT on CBS, and his credits include shows like Friday Night Lights and The Get Down. Hi, Aaron. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Gina.
Hey. So, first of all, tell me about that photo going viral. Was that kind of funny to you?
Yes, funny and unexpected. The outing to see Black Panther was kind of something that was put together by friends of mine and I, and just we're looking to celebrate the release, and there were friends of ours that were involved in the film, and you know, we're happy to see that there is such a great and enthusiastic response to the film, and the photo was just kind of a byproduct of that, so we didn't expect anything to happen because of it.
You know, culturally, in so many ways, this feels like a moment. Does it feel like a moment for people of color doing creative work that does usually happen invisibly behind the scenes?
It does for a number of reasons, mainly because Hollywood hasn't traditionally ever seen a big major motion picture, you know, meaning a film that's over $100 million in budget, be produced with people of color prominently being featured, not only as actors in front of the screen, but also behind the scenes. You know, a friend of ours, Joe Robert Cole, was the co-writer on the film, and then the director, Ryan Coogler, who was the co-writer and director of the film, was also a friend. So that's unprecedented going back in the history of Hollywood. That's never happened where a film was made with people of color prominently involved and did so well with so much money at stake.
Why is it important for there to be behind-the-scenes people who are representing different communities? I mean, not just people on screen.
Well, you know, it's important. It's a great question, and it's important for a lot of different reasons. You know, representation obviously does matter, and it's one of those things where we're very aware that, you know, young people looking up, you know, people across the world who view American films, and we always say that American pop culture, American Hollywood filmmaking is probably the most effective American export there is. You know, representation across the world matters as to how people are represented. Stories that we tell are the things that tend to be our legacy. And so from that standpoint, it's very important. And then from the standpoint of being truthful to the art itself, to the craft, you know, to infuse these stories with different points of view, to flesh out the perspective that we're hearing, we feel is tremendously important. And you get that perspective from people that bring it to the table. So just by opening up the table, the discussion, you're going to get different types of stories.
I mentioned that you're from KCK. How do you think things that you experienced in your upbringing inform the work you do, the stories you do tell on television?
Well, I'm tremendously proud to be from KCK and from Wyandotte County. And there's definitely a perspective coming from Wyandotte County where it's a little bit of an underdog mentality, I feel. Already from a city in the Midwest that may get overlooked. It's called the flyover zone for a reason by the coast. But then even within that city itself, there are areas that might be the drive-through areas, I suppose. And Wyandotte has always been one of those areas. So I think coming from Wyandotte, there's a scrappy attitude from everyone there that you have to fight for everything that you get. And that definitely helped me in a competitive environment like Hollywood, where that is the status quo.
You know, I'm curious what race might also have to do with that, since that's how we started this conversation.
Well, race has a tremendous, tremendous impact on that. You know, my production company, Art Productions, uses the Kansas license plate as its logo. And in the upper left-hand corner of that license plate is WY for Wyandotte. And when I was a teenager driving around Kansas City, WY in the upper left-hand corner on a Kansas license plate was always code for black, basically. And if you're a young black male driving that car, then, you know, I kind of joke now about it, although at the time it wasn't necessarily funny. There was definitely a greater likelihood that you would get pulled over if you had the WY in your license plate. So it kind of went hand in hand. Being from Wyandotte County, being black was kind of a given. And therefore, I wear it as a badge of honor, and it definitely stays with me to this day. And then there's also just the history of the area. You know, Kansas City lies, obviously, in a way where you have the Missouri River separating Kansas City, Kansas from Kansas City, Missouri. And I always joke with friends of mine regarding the Kansas-Missouri rivalry that, you know, if you go back 200 years, definitely Kansas is where you want it to be. It's the free state, you know. And so I think that infuses African Americans from the Kansas City, Kansas side to this day. Definitely infuses me with that attitude of knowing you can overcome anything. You work hard enough, but that starts with the state of Kansas.
You know, you're working right now on SWAT, and I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that show. I'm going to play a bit of a trailer for one of the episodes in a minute, but first of all, just tell us about that project and what it is that makes you excited about it.
Well, what makes me excited about SWAT was the original concept that occurred to me years ago, which is an idea of, and this is before it became a hot topic in the news, because it's always been a topic since the beginning of the country, was the idea of how police officers relate to the community, and in particular African American communities, the Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter debate, so to speak. That's how it's been coined recently. And I always had an idea, you know, when I was a kid and I lived in Kansas City, Kansas, we had a complicated relationship with police officers. You know, on one hand, you know, there's a next door neighbor of mine who at 12 years old was shot and killed by a police officer. On the other hand, one of the other neighbors to my other side was a police officer, and we really thought he was really cool. He was a guy that taught you how to ride a bike. So we had a literal love-hate relationship with police officers, and I always thought it would be interesting to portray a character who understood both sides of that debate.
Yeah, this is a good time, I think, to listen to this clip. This is a clip from a trailer, and when we start out, this SWAT sergeant rushes in to help a kid who's just been shot by one of his colleagues.
Hey, kid, look at me. Talk to me. Talk to me. What's your name?
Raymond.
Raymond? All right. You live here? Yeah? Well, me too. I grew up four blocks that way.
Ambulance went to the wrong spot. They're still 10 minutes out.
This kid doesn't have 10 minutes. Get him on the truck. You and me, we got this. We both fight together.
What happened? Our neighborhood is all shut to hell.
Not our bullets.
What about the bullet in that kid?
It was a split-second call. Bullets were flying.
Last night, 17-year-old Raymond Harris was accidentally shot by SWAT team leader Buck Spivey. This morning, I terminated Sergeant Spivey. Actions have consequences. Today, I am assigning Sergeant Daniel Harrells command of this unit.
Buck, this is wrong. It was an accident.
Not one that I would tolerate on my team.
It's your job now.
I'm at the crossroads of wrong and right.
This is the third shooting here in the last 6 months.
That was a clip from SWAT, and producer Aaron Rashawn Thomas is here talking with us about that show and about his experiences. He's a KCK native working in Hollywood. And Aaron, there is a lot of nuance in how you're depicting this police shooting of a young black man.
Yes, well, it's intentional. Thank you. Thank you for saying that, because we worked hard to find the balance in how much nuance we want to show and how much clarity we want to be absolutely, we want to make sure is there. So, you know, it's no small thing to get a show off the ground on a network like CBS that reaches the masses, and to try to actually tackle certain difficult subjects while you're entertaining. And that's a balance that we work very hard to try to achieve.
You know, it's partly that you're looking at all of this through the eyes of a black sergeant.
Yes. Well, you know, in the spirit of representation, in the spirit of telling new types of stories, I thought it would be a really interesting spin on a police procedural. You know, We have the high action element that was definitely achieved through working with Justin Lin, who was the director of many of the Fast and Furious movies, and you know, as a guru master when it comes to the action aspect. But you also have the aspect of heart at the center of it, where we felt like, you know, we can flip what you expect from a police procedural by putting a character you don't normally see in that position with a dilemma that you don't normally see. And so, you know, having Hondo, having a black sergeant at the heart of that, and also not only that, but a black sergeant who has military background and also grew up in the inner city, we felt like, you know, this may be a character that can understand a lot of different sides of the debate, again, between police and community.
You know, you and I were in the same high school class, and we've stayed in touch on Facebook. So obviously, I know a little bit of your story, but not all of it. When did you get interested in becoming a writer?
Well, you know, talking about, I mean, kind of, writing is one of those things, not to sound cliche, but it does kind of choose you. You know, I realize now that I've always enjoyed writing. I remember, you know, getting bit by the bug, consciously being bit by the bug when I was 6 years old in first grade. We had an assignment to write about your favorite outfit, and I wrote about a Spider-Man outfit, and I was very proud of that in a little paragraph of describing my Spider-Man outfit. I remember another class assignment in fifth grade where we were required to create our own Greek myth from scratch, and I took that assignment very seriously. It was extra credit, but I worked couple of days on it, and I created a myth about how eclipses were created and why they were named eclipses, because there's a guy named Eclipso who was given wings by Hermes and had to fly up and move the moon in front of the sun. I was very happy about that. It just gave me a lot of joy to tell stories, because I felt like you communicate with people in that way. It's a way of reaching people. And then when I reached high school, you know, it kind of took on a different element when I was enrolled in a class called Electronic Imagery. It's taught by Kathy Williams at Pembroke Hill. And at Pembroke Hill, that class required us to not only write stories, but then to go out and shoot them on what at the time, and this is, I will date myself by saying this, but at the time was VHS, very ancient method of recording now. But that was just a lot of fun, because you could put a visual element to your storytelling. And then that was it. Once I experienced that, it was kind of like, you know, that's no matter what, I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. But I didn't know I could earn a living at it until I reached college.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to get to college in just a second. But in high school, you were already making movies about race with one of our other classmates. And that was in a mostly white environment. What was that like?
It was exhilarating and scary at the same time. Friend of mine and I, we're still good friends, James Nelson, and I were both bit by lightning at the exact same time. We had gone to, there was an independent study project every year that students could sign up to do, and you would get credit for it, you'd get a grade for it. And we both, weirdly, independently at the same time, had the same idea. We literally ran up to each other after an assembly, and we were both like, we should make a movie. We should make a movie about our experience of being African-American inner-city kids attending a mostly white private school in Kansas City. And it was just kind of meant to be. So we set out to make a film that we called Fade to Black. And Fade to Black was about two students. He and I played those students because we couldn't afford actors. We couldn't afford anything. It's called a no-budget film is what we were making. And we told a story about our experiences of coming from inner-city, attending a private high school, but we decided that if we're going to tell the story, we're going to tell it warts and all. We're going to be very honest about the highs, the lows, the good, the bad, you know, the microaggressions that we would run into, the blatant racism that we run into at times, and the bias on all sides. You know, when you go to a private school, what kind of reception do you get from your own family or from cousins? You know, do you have to prove that you're blacker than, you know, you have to prove that you're still black because you go to a school like that. When you're at a school like that, do you have to overcompensate in certain areas, you know, or do you face certain resistance, you know, that kind of thing. So
I'd love to hear your answers to some of those questions.
Well, there are a lot of questions. That's something that at the time we were eager to do is we ended up, you know, we basically packed about everything that we could into that movie. We ended up making a 2-hour movie as juniors in high school with very limited means and very limited equipment. And it was all born out of passion and love. And at the same time, you know, there's a little bit of fear because we knew that by criticizing the school and criticizing the way things were done at the school, that not everyone would be a fan, that that might ruffle a few feathers. And we were even warned on more than one occasion by a few different teachers that, you know, what you're doing, you know, takes a lot of guts, you know, in a way that's like, maybe you should not be doing it. But that bolstered us to do it, want to do it even more. You know, we knew that we were on the right track. We knew that it was really important, and it's just something that both of us needed to get done. And I'm so glad that we did it, because to open up conversation regarding the experience of, at the time, where we're scholarship students who were attending the school.
So you had a lot on the line, too, in the form of a scholarship.
I had a full ride. My friend, I think, pretty close to that. You know, and even bigger than that, you know, both of us were coming from families with limited means. So, you know, private school educations were not exactly abundant, you know. And also, even though we didn't necessarily fully understand the value of the private school education, our parents did. They felt very, you know, strongly about it. So there was an awareness for sure that, you know, there was worth on that side. And there's also the stakes of, you know, the students coming after us. You know, we want to be responsible about our message, ruffle feathers, but also at the same time, open things up so that they can get better.
Is that, you know, pretty much what you're still doing in your career? I mean, I'm curious about whether your story is one you think needs to be told more. I mean, coming from your background, the path from there to the kind of career you have now, to who you are and what you do now.
That is flattering to think about. You know, I mean, I mean, in some ways, I'm telling my story even as I go. You know, I try to, you know, every time I talk about the things that are important to me, and SWAT is included in that, you know, I feel like each project has elements of you know, values and priorities that I've always held very dear to my heart, and I still do. So I kind of look at every project I work on, I definitely try to infuse it, you know, with things that are very, very, you know, close to my own priorities.
Aaron Rashawn Thomas, great catching up with you.
Thanks, Gina. Thanks for having me.
A picture of Aaron and his friends watching Black Panther went viral online, bringing attention to Black creatives in Hollywood. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard is off to a short break. We'll be right back. And now, mosquitoes. You might think it's kind of an off-season for mosquitoes here in town, but that's exactly what makes the timing right for mosquito scientists to have a conference. The foremost mosquito experts are here in Kansas City right now, dealing with some of the most pressing mosquito questions. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're joined by one of those experts, Dr. Derek Nimmo, director of U.S. Oxitec Operations, where he's been reprogramming mosquito genetics. And that raises all kinds of ethical questions and practical ones, too. More on that in a second. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
You're working on making friendly mosquitoes, is that right?
That's right, yes. We've named them friendly mosquitoes because we've been releasing them in Brazil for the past 5 to 6 years. And where we've been releasing them, in this town called Piracicaba, the people there have been so sort of happy that we're releasing them and pleased with the results that they named them Aedes dabum, which roughly translates to the good or friendly mosquito. So we thought, great, that's a fantastic name for them. So we've called them the friendly mosquitoes.
Okay, how do you make a friendly mosquito, and what makes it friendly?
So we have inserted two genes into this mosquito. One of those genes is called a self-limiting gene. And this gene, when it's inherited by offspring, causes them to die. So what happens is we release the friendly mosquitoes, which are males, and males don't bite or transmit disease. It's only the females that bite because they need the blood meal to produce eggs. And so those males we release, they mate with the females, pass on the self-limiting gene, the offspring die. And if you release over a long enough period of time, you can crash the population. And we've shown
see,
that.
This doesn't sound that friendly. On well, our part, perhaps.
Well, it's not friendly to the mosquito, of course, but it's obviously they're friendly because it's a male and it does not bite. And so the males that we release, they have one job to do, and that's pass on their genes. And when they do that, the offspring die. And we can control this mosquito called Aedes aegypti, which is a mosquito that transmits dengue, Zika, chikungunya, yellow fever. And it's actually non-native. It's not meant to be anywhere in the Americas. It actually got transported out of Northeast Africa in the past few hundred years, mainly by humans transporting the mosquito around the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're moving around the world, and yet we're so bothered by mosquitoes joining us.
We are. And, you know, most mosquitoes aren't a problem. There's 80 or so different species in Florida alone. There's 3,000 in the world. And most of those don't bother us whatsoever. They have their function, they do their job, there's no hassle. But there's a certain percentage that do spread diseases and cause serious problems for humans.
So, but you are essentially trying to wipe out the mosquito population, it sounds like. I mean, self-limiting genes, that's a nice way of saying you aren't going to continue much past now.
Well, exactly. So the self-limiting gene itself means that when we do our releases, we release the males, they pass on that self-limited gene, the offspring die, and there's nothing left in the environment. So yes, we are trying to control this mosquito or eradicate this mosquito. But we have to remember this mosquito is non-native. It's not meant to be here. It lives in and around people's homes, which is an artificial environment anyway. And it's very specialized to feeding on humans. The Aedes aegypti female will almost exclusively bite a human. If you're in the middle of a field with loads of cows around you, that Aedes aegypti female will bite you and nothing else.
Okay, I don't like the sound of that, and I will admit that. But there has to be some, I mean, there has to be something good to some creature on this planet about this mosquito, right? Or no?
Well, because it's spread around the world, no. I mean, nothing feeds on it. It's not any sort of predators that exclusively feed on this mosquito. This particular mosquito in Florida makes up less than 1% of the biomass of all mosquitoes, let alone all insects. So it's not a major food source. It's non-native. It's not meant to be here. Getting rid of it effectively restores the environment.
Do you have any qualms about the ethics? I mean, it feels like kind of an ethical landmine, reprogramming the genetic code of a species.
Well, it's not reprogramming it. We're just using the genetics to control the species. So we're not changing the genetic code of the species in any way. We're just using it as a method to control it in the environment.
Can you explain that a little bit more, the difference between those two things?
Yes, certainly. So where we've done the genetic transformation is in the laboratory. And we have a strain that the friendly mosquito strain that we have in the laboratory. When we release that strain, it doesn't spread in the environment. It doesn't replace anything. It just controls that mosquito. So let's say we did a program where we got rid of the mosquito and people said, well, actually, we want the mosquito back. Fine. Well, we stop releases and the mosquito comes back. There's no permanent effect of what we're doing on the population or the environment. And we're not proposing to eradicate this mosquito from the world. We're just proposing to eradicate this mosquito from places where it's not meant to be.
So I guess the part of this that I'm not following is the self-limiting piece of it. That does seem like a change to me in that future generations of this mosquito that would otherwise exist now will not.
I see. No. So when we release our males, they only live a couple of days. They mate females and pass on the self-limiting gene. Their offspring die. So if you stopped releases, you don't affect anything in the environment. You only keep the effect going by keeping the releases going. So once you stop, you don't continue to to control the mosquito in any way. There's no spread in the environment. There's no effect on the genes. The only thing that happens is that it, you know, the mosquito could come back if you stop releases.
Are there questions you have when you think about how this affects various environments, how it affects humans, how it affects the ecosystems?
Yes, and these questions have all been asked by regulatory agencies around the world. So we have been through the regulatory process in Cayman Islands, in Brazil, in Panama, in Malaysia, and also in the US. And in the US, we went through an environmental assessment with the FDA, with experts from the EPA and the CDC a couple of years ago. And they assessed everything from the environment, human health, animal health, down to the gene itself, the products of the gene, whether they're toxic, whether they're anagenic, what if you get bitten by a female. All those aspects have been analyzed. And there was a comment period of 60 days where anybody could comment from around the world. And they did. There was over 2,700 comments.
Oh, my God. What kinds of things did people say?
Well, they range from fairly crazy through to, you know, how will this affect, you know, my predators? How will this affect me? And also some letters of support for the technology to say that, you know, this is something that is needed. Aedes aegypti is a very hard mosquito to control. You can't control it with current control methods very well. And it's resistant to a lot of the current insecticides. And it transmits all these very nasty diseases. So it's a mosquito where new tools are desperately required.
There isn't, you know, within the kind of high-level scientific research world, there aren't so many topics that would necessarily get that volume of response. And I have to imagine it's because almost everyone has had direct interactions with mosquitoes. Can you talk a little bit about working in a field that's so specialized, but also so close to so many individuals, human beings out there hearing about what you're doing?
Everyone seems to have an opinion about mosquitoes, that's for sure. And most people really don't like getting bitten by mosquitoes. And that's something that obviously the Mosquito Control Association meeting is all about. It's a gathering of all the experts from around America who are the practical end of controlling mosquitoes. And it's their job to balance the control of mosquitoes with people's, you know, wishes not to get bitten, but also to, you know, not affect the environment that they're in as well. And that's a delicate balance. And that's why there's so much research and so much work being performed on this sort of control.
Is there talk of eradicating mosquitoes? Because I've never heard about anything good that they do. But at the same time, you don't know.
Well, in certain mosquito species that are, you know, present in the environment in large numbers, yes, you would argue that eradication could cause environmental effects. And then you have to be...
But like what?
Well, there's certain species of mosquito like salt marsh mosquitoes that occur in very large numbers, and they could be a food source for other organisms in the environment and a significant food source as well. Fish or other invertebrates. And so there you could see an argument to say eradication might not be the best option. Let's go for more control of the mosquito, either controlling the numbers or being able to, you know, have effective repellents so people just don't get bitten. So the mosquito is still there, but you just don't get bitten. So there's many sort of different ways you can tackle this. But I would say there's a very small number of mosquitoes that transmit some very nasty diseases, including West Nile virus, Eastern equine encephalitis, that we should consider reducing to the minimum amount possible. And that might not be eradication, but that might be very low numbers.
How do you determine how low a number is safe?
Yeah, so there's a lot of research that's been done on the level of mosquitoes and the disease transmission threshold, it's called. So you need a certain number of mosquitoes to transmit diseases because it's all about risk and chance, the chance that a mosquito bites somebody or something that's been infected and then transmits that to somebody else. and you
need. It seems like one mosquito is enough to give someone a disease.
Yes, you know, one mosquito, there's always the chance that it can transfer a disease from one person to another. But to actually have disease transmission on a regular basis and to be kept going, you need a certain level of mosquitoes. And that's what you're trying to get under.
It all sounds not only incredibly sci-fi, but also very sci-fi in the sense of us against them.
Well, I mean, it's not us against them. It's a natural thing in the environment. We are humans. We want to stop people getting diseases. And we have these powerful new tools in the genetics approaches that are coming along now that are enabling us to do it in a much more precise way than we have done before. So previous insecticides and other tools have had a general effect on the environment. They don't just kill the insects, they kill, the mosquito, they kill other insects. And they have off-target effects, where we now have a tool that is very specific. It will only get rid of Aedes aegypti in the environment. That male will only mate Aedes aegypti females and will not affect anything else in the environment. So I think that's a very powerful tool and a very new method that has huge advantages over previous methods with these new genetic tools.
But what about the Pandora's box effect? You know, maybe this tool gets used in this very targeted way in the work you're doing. Could it be used in scarier, less targeted ways? My sci-fi brain is running away with me, so forgive me.
No, it's okay. And there's a lot of that sort of fear in the population, and I would say no.
There's no danger.
I'd never.
But see, that's exactly what would happen in a science fiction
there is
movie.
Never,
the scientist would say no chance
there
of that.
There is never no danger. But what we can say for sure is that we know everything about that gene, where it's inserted, what the product is, how it works, whether it's toxic, allergenic. We know everything about it. But in most other products that you eat, that you consume every day, you don't know what's in there. You don't know what's happening. You don't know normal breeding processes where you breed two plants together. Hundreds of genes are changed when you do that. And nobody seems to have that sort of fear of that. And that's happening naturally in the environment every day. Every time you eat something, you're eating DNA. You're eating genetics. You're eating viruses. You're eating bacteria. And everybody lives, everybody survives. We're just using those tools to make it a far more accurate process to be able to manipulate it in a way that is advantageous to what we want. And the regulations on this are immense. You know, genetic products and crops and like our mosquito have been through the regulatory process for years, if not decades, and have been more studied than any other product that I know.
So could your friendly mosquito also be called the GMO mosquito?
Yes, of course. Yes, it's a genetically modified organism. And we have inserted these two genes, the self-limiting gene and also the marker gene, which I didn't get a chance to talk about. But that's also a powerful tool that we use to sort of track and trace the mosquito in the environment, so we can actually show that it doesn't spread and that it is self-limiting.
As you work with mosquitoes, it's one thing that I have trouble imagining if I'm putting myself in your shoes is that, you know, you're spending years and years working closely with this creature. But does that lead you to feel any kind of affection for it almost, or no?
I think I like mosquitoes. I've worked with them for over 25 years. I've been rearing. I love photography. I take pictures of mosquitoes. It's one of my hobbies, the macro photography. I happen to think they're quite beautiful close up.
What is beautiful about them?
Well, I mean, there's the colors, there's the banding, there's the how such a small little insect can have this amazing structures to the proboscis of the female, for example. That has seven different mouth parts to it, each one different tasks, one for sawing through the skin, another pair to inject saliva, another one to take the blood up. It's amazing how
that does sound beautiful now that you talk about taking the blood up.
It's true. Yes, there are some not so nice things about mosquitoes, and one of them is the blood feeding.
But so, as you attend this conference of mosquito experts all talking about mosquito controlling here in Kansas City, are there things you're excited to learn about or questions that you have that you're really eager to discuss with your fellow mosquito experts?
Of course. So, being in the sort of genetically modified arena, to be honest, a lot of people come to me and ask about information about, where we are in the process, in the regulatory process down in Monroe County, where we're proposing to do the pilot study. And B, what's new, what's happening, where we're doing releases elsewhere in the world, and the successes we've had around there. But for me personally, it's learning about, how other people are doing mosquito control and how effective they're being, where they're having problems, issues, and whether, these new tools that are being developed, not just ours, but others, could be of use to them.
You talked about releasing these mosquitoes in Brazil, mm-hmm. and I'm curious to know a little bit more about that experience. It sounds like the community there was really engaged with what you were doing.
Very much so. So part of our standard sort of procedure is to do a lot of community engagement. We have to inform the public, how it works, what it is, what we're doing, where we're doing it, and how it's going to work. And we've been very transparent about that everywhere we've been.
So no secret GMO mosquitoes?
Of course not. Of course not. And so, we announce months before we actually start any releases. Obviously, we go through the regulatory process beforehand, which is usually very public. And there's always a public comment period where people can put their comments in for review. And then obviously we do usually do a pilot study, relatively small scale, which we've done three of in Brazil, one in Cayman, one in Panama, all with independent collaborators. So this is not just Oxitec, this is independent collaborators. They do the monitoring, they get the results for us, and then we publish most of those in peer-reviewed journals. So this is all information that has been peer-reviewed and checked.
Derek Nimmo, thanks for taking a break from the Mosquito Conference to talk with us today.
My pleasure, Gina. Thank you.
I will think of you when I get my first mosquito bite this season.
I hope you don't.
Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, a theater director tells us about the experience she's brought back with her from South American travels that finds its way into her Kansas City productions. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. And before we go, let's talk with a local theater director, Karen Lissandra. She's got a production on stage this week at UMKC called The Storytelling Project. But it's her story that we're hoping to hear today. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Gina.
The Storytelling Project draws inspiration from some of your own experiences in the Andes, specifically with Andean Cosmovision.
Yes, I spent 6 years in the Andes after spending about 6.5, 7 years in Argentina. So it was very much a journey from the formal physical theater to a spiritual journey in the Andes of learning all about the mythological archetypes, how mythology is such a part of Andean reality. And so it was a learning experience that went beyond the beyond typical Eurocentric theater, which I was used to.
Yeah. Here. Okay. So tell me more about that journey. First of all, what brought you to South America?
I was living in the Philippines for a year after college, and I wanted to learn Spanish. Art really brought me down. The tango. Some movies that I saw that were shot in Argentina, and the fact that I couldn't have any expectations of Argentina, just because it was such a mix of European migration plus a lot of indigenous tribes from the south of Argentina as well. So that mix really opened my eyes, really kind of caught my attention.
There was it sounds like there was a creative question you were asking about influences on theater and where they come from, and just questioning what you maybe took for granted being here a little bit. But I'm also curious about what personally might have been drawing you in that direction?
I went down to Argentina in the first place because there's for somebody looking for themselves. I was young. I was in my early 20s, going to a place where you couldn't have any expectations. What a great place to find yourself. Also in a region that there's so much art in Buenos Aires. There's over 200 working theaters. The music scene is phenomenal. So you can, you know, you just, you wander and you find so many things in your periphery.
But then you went from there to Bolivia, right?
Yes, I got hired by a company in Bolivia that the director was Argentine, but he was exiled because of the dictatorship in Argentina. And when he came back, he wanted to go to a place that was a little bit more rooted in the indigenous practices. So he went to Bolivia and started a theater company. And it's funny because you'd never think, especially being a girl who was born in Hutchinson, Kansas, being a professional actress, I'd want to go to Bolivia. But from there, we would spend about a year creating a show, and then we went on tour for 3 years to over 10 countries, New Zealand, all over Europe, all over South America.
Tell me more about the experience in Bolivia, because you were mentioning that this was maybe a more spiritual approach to theater than what you were accustomed to.
Yes, it's very organic. And in that sense, the auditions aren't very quick. You don't go there, you do a monologue, and that's it. It was probably a month-long process of seeing what your character is, if you can get along with the group. If you're going to be together in an ensemble for 4 years, it's not product-driven, really. It's about the experience that you can have and a dynamic that you can have in a group as individuals.
So as opposed to being handed a script or something like that?
Yes, all the theater I did in South America was all experimental based. It was all devised theater, which means that we create the script. For a couple of the projects, there were adaptions of scripts. So I was Calypso in the Odyssey, but it was written with the perspective of immigration, and especially the Bolivian immigration and the diaspora. So
how is the story of the Odyssey different from that perspective? What is the story transformed into? Well, and who is Calypso?
So in that perspective, Calypso was Calypso is such an interesting character for me because I think she's taken for granted. She's sort of seen as the other woman.
Who is she in the Odyssey?
In the Odyssey. So, Calypso, she is the demigoddess. She's an island nymph, basically, that the main character, Odysseus, stayed with for 7 years on his way after the Trojan War before making his way to Ithaca, his hometown.
And so the story gets transformed and the character gets transformed. How?
So basically, Ulysses or Odysseus, his journey of going instead of island to island in the Greek mythological story, it became Ulysses or Odysseus going to the United States from Bolivia all the way through through Mexico, and especially about the train. We did a lot of investigation of the immigrants' process crossing the desert, and then what they leave behind, and how difficult the process is. So a lot of that came across when we're in Europe, for instance, and a lot of South Americans came to see the show, and it was telling their story on stage and feeling represented by international artists of color in festivals. So it was quite an experience.
What was it like for you to be watching different audiences all over the world responding to this story at this moment in history?
I learned how important the image was of of people of different backgrounds working together. So in the theater company I was working with, we had an Italian lady, a German lady, two Argentine guys, a Bolivian woman, three Bolivians, and I was the Asian American actress, and so the Asian North American, I would say, because we were all, in a sense, most of us were of the Americas. So and after working together over a year and then altogether 4 years, you see that connection that we have is a very human connection, and one that in an energetic subtext of the show really was transmitted. That's what I thought with seeing that in all these different audiences and the reactions.
Yeah, so take me back to Cosmovision, because that's where we started. And Dan Cosmovision finds its way into your current project, the storytelling project, in a pretty significant way. So I want to understand what it is and how it affected you.
So the Cosmovision basically is how people relate to, I guess, their cosmology, which is creation stories, the origin of the universe. And so the vision is, I take it as a more of an internal consciousness and how that informs artistic practice, life practice. So it's,
can you explain that a little more? Like, if I'm a person trying to understand my cosmology, what am I trying to understand?
Let's see. So I think there's a lot of self-reflection involved of how what your relationship is to the earth, for instance, in Andean terms, the Pachamama. So there's a lot of rituals to the earth, and just the way that every action that you create or that you take in life, how that reflects your belief system. And in the Andes, because their history and their mythology, it's one and the same. There's a lot of their rituals in their festivals, which keeps the memory of this Cosmovision alive.
Can you give me an example to help illustrate this?
Yeah, sure. So one of the characters we have in the show, his name is Hachatata Dansanti. And in the Andean community outside of La Paz, Bolivia, it's Achacachi, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And in their community, they actually choose a warrior, somebody who's very strong, and they'll have a ceremony for him to dance for 3 days until they die. And it's something that still goes on today. I'm not exactly sure if they dance to the death, but the mask is so large that oftentimes it'll break the dancer's neck when they're so exhausted.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, and there's some Bolivian rituals that that have to deal with the sacrifice to the Mother Earth, so sacrificing their life or their own blood in order for love for the community, for to ward off calamities and droughts and things like that.
How do you translate these concepts and just everything that you've brought from this worldwide journey back to your work here in Kansas City?
So that was the fun part about it. We take the actors and their real stories through basically the Andean concept of Pachacutec, which is, it's like an earthquake. It's the chaos in order to open some self-reflection. So each of them brought to the story, the storytelling project, their own personal conflicts and obstacles. And then from that, I won't say how, but they cross a portal, which is called the Chicana. It's the Andean cross, and they get to these three worlds, which is parallel to the like Greek mythology or Nordic mythology of the different worlds. So from there, then we get to the Cosmovision.
We are listening to some music from the Storytelling Project on our way out. What can you tell me just briefly about what we're hearing?
Oh, so this is an original composition by Amado Espinosa, who's the musical director and just happens to be my husband. He's also Bolivian, so he's playing an invention. It's the Bolivian charango mixed with the American banjo. So the sound is something that's very new here, and it's for the subtext of one of the actors' monologues.
Karen Lissandra, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
You can catch the Storytelling Project through March 4th at UMKC. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.